Thank you, Maya and Karen. That was fascinating, and it just, I think rich is the word that just comes to me after hearing just this wealth of the personal stories. There's so much in that for us to take to create our future art and to learn from and be inspired from. And we also learn from history and hope to never repeat it in many cases. And our next speaker is going to talk about how important that is and how some people realize that, and this exceptional person who Ralph Pugh is going to talk about realized that just after the events of the Holocaust happened. And Ralph is going to talk. His talk is called A Collection of Interviews with Displaced Persons, recorded by Dr. David Boder in the aftermath of World War II. And Ralph Pugh is assistant university archivist at Illinois Institute of Technology, where he also teaches the history of Chicago and modern Europe on an adjunct basis. He holds a master's and doctorate degree in history from the University of Chicago, but most of his career has been spent in the archival and museum fields, where he has applied his historical training and perspectives to the tasks of historical preservation, cataloging, and public programming. Prior to the Illinois Institute of Technology, he worked at the Chicago History Museum, serving in turn as an archivist and as a public historian engaged in exhibit development, most notably curating the Chicago History Museum's component of the Smithsonian's traveling exhibition on the American presidency. So please join me in welcoming Ralph Pugh. And also, as promised, I'm gonna get that up for you, and where's the, I'm gonna get the internet up for you too.
Sure. Karen, I'm appreciative of the assist as well, technology.
There we go, I know how it is.
That's it, that's right.
Okay, so, oop, there we go, so, control.
There it is. Okay, good morning. First off, as the introduction indicated, I was at the Chicago Historical Society, now the CHM, for 23 years before I started at IIT. Studs Terkel, at the end of his career on radio, I've got to segue here, in the late 1990s was brought on staff at the CHS as under the title of a visiting scholar. He spent most of the remaining years of his life assisting staff in cataloging his material. And so I got to know Studs to a certain degree. I found from that experience that I've never found anyone so completely extroverted, somebody who was such a complete public persona. There was no private aspect to Studs. Studs was, he was his brand. In the men's room, I have to tell this anecdote. There was never any privacy with Studs. Only the men at CHS would know this. You'd go into the men's room, you'd be doing your business, and Studs would come in, and as soon as he hit the door, he would proclaim to whoever was in there what he was going to do. The door would open, I gotta go number one. Door would open, I gotta go number two. It's like, Studs, this isn't a public place. You don't have to be telling us what you're going to do. I mean, this is actually one of the few spaces where it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. We're just going to do things, and it's off the record. You know, it's perfectly fine. But it's great working with people in contexts like that. You really get to see, you know, who they are. Quite an interesting fellow. All right, moving on to my own area, besides Studs. As indicated, I'm now at the Illinois Institute of Technology, been there since 2006. When I came on board in the archives operation there, the then director of the library system wishing to push forward on a website, or completing a website on our most important audio collection, the audio files of Professor David Pablo Boder, who had been at the Illinois Institute of Technology from the 1940s until his retirement in 1952. Boder, and I'll just launch into a biographical background. You kind of need to understand a bit about him before the materials make sense. Boder was born in 1886 in Latvia, Jewish heritage. His name actually was Aaron Mendel Michelson. His father was an official in the Tsarist civil service. So even though they were a Jewish family, his father was connected through the bureaucracy with the Tsarist regime. And it's the first indication that Boder was on something of an interface situation with his life. He traversed different communities. Being Jewish meant that in the Tsarist regime of Russia, that things could turn badly for you at a moment's notice. But on the other hand, he's born in the Baltic states, which is a part of the Russian Empire, which had a bit more tolerance, tradition of tolerance for the Jewish minority, those having been formerly Swedish provinces. And so Boder knew he was Jewish, was educated in state schools that also taught the Jewish heritage, but his father was connected with the regime. And so there was this sort of being part of the elite, but not being part of the elite, very much an uncomfortable reality. But that particular family was able to avail itself of the educational opportunities of the time. Young Aaron partook of university, gymnasiums, became interested in the new discipline of psychology, and in 1906 went to the University of Leipzig, where he studied under Wilhelm Wundt, and tagged his career, set his career on the path towards psychology, and continued his education through the 19-teens. Of course, the First World War comes, he's swept up in the war. He becomes a Bolshevik, although not a Leninist. He's kind of a more of a soft Bolshevik. He's elected to the Constituent Assembly of 1918. Those of you who know your Russian history will find that to be significant. That's quite an honor. That assembly never meets because the Bolshevik Revolution under the Leninists occurs, and that assembly is not permitted to be seated. Michelson decides to leave Russia at that point, gets out via Vladivostok, and works his way toward Mexico, where he teaches in the early 1920s at university in Mexico City. Where he continues his devotion to psychology. But it's clear that he's positioning himself in Mexico City so that he can work up toward the United States. And in 1925, he succeeds in getting across the border into the United States, completes his education at Northwestern University and the University of Chicago in Chicago. And then starts teaching in Chicago in the late 1920s at Lewis Institute, which was one of the predecessor schools of the Illinois Institute of Technology. So he's working his way into what is now the Illinois Institute of Technology. Boder is married a few times, first married around 1906, divorced. We have really no information about why that occurred and what happened to the first wife. Second wife, he marries while he's still in Russia. She comes with him to Mexico. She dies not long after the arrival in Mexico. There's a daughter by the first marriage, the only child he has, Elena, who is active in his life for the rest of his life, but she's the only heir. And then in the United States, Boder marries a third time. But as I indicate, by the 1920s, he's in the U.S. His education had been interrupted by the Russian Revolution, so as I indicated, he completes it at the University of Chicago and at Northwestern, and he's on staff now as an academic psychologist at Lewis Institute, which is one of these night school-type universities, colleges, catering more toward working-class clientele with a more flexible academic scheduling opportunity for people who are attempting to do their education at night or weekends or whatnot. And Boder is very dedicated to popularizing psychology, both in the academic circles, but also to lay people. In terms of his academic credential, his academic focus, here's a photo of Boder presenting on psychology at a International Congress of Psychology at Copenhagen in 1932. You can see he's at the podium there, where he presented on some of his projects at Lewis Institute. He's a Renaissance man in many ways. As you saw a few slides back, he's playing the cello. He's interested in psychology as very much a humanist discipline. He certainly treats it as a social science, but he's also interested in it as a fuller way of accessing the human experience. He's also very keen on educating people in this new discipline. So in Chicago in the 1930s, he creates what was known as the Psychological Museum. He actually rents a few rooms and he puts up test equipment and psychological experiments so that people could come in off the street and participate in the psychological exercises and experiments to show people how some of the mechanics of the discipline worked in terms of documenting and testing human behavior. So he's busy teaching at Lewis. He's also busy keeping the Psychological Museum going. So this is what he does as the 1930s give way to the 1940s. And of course, in the 1940s, the U.S. is in the war in 1941, Boder switches his work in psychology more toward disciplines that would help the war effort. And of course, academia did its part in winning the war. So Boder does this change in his research to benefit the war effort. And now we get to what can be really called the sort of IIT portion of this narrative. Lewis Institute in 1940 merges with Armour Institute, which was a near North Side institute, Bread Brick University, same sort of thing, catering more toward people with challenged schedules, more modest student body. Lewis Institute and Armour Institute come together in 1940 to create the Illinois Institute of Technology. And they share Armour's campus after 1940. So now we're into IIT history after 1940. This is an interesting synergy which is about to occur. Boder comes from Lewis as part of a humanist and social science operation, which is now part of IIT, whereas Armour Institute brings more of the hard sciences with it, and research and engineering. Armour Research Foundation, which is mentioned on the slide here, was the for-hire research arm of the Armour Institute. So Boder is brought into this newly created melded environment at IIT in 1940. He's a psychologist and whatnot, but he meets this young fellow here, Marvin Camrus, who's a recent graduate of Armour Institute just before the merger. Camrus is hired on by the Armour Research Foundation, and Camrus invents the wire recorder. So this is one of IIT's claims to fame, as young Marvin Camrus, just in his early 20s, creates the wire recorder. As we get to the end of the Second War, Boder realizes that he has an opportunity to go to Europe to resume some field studies for his psychology, his career. But he realizes, well, he could take this wire recorder with him and tape or wire materials in the field, interviews in the field. And so he and Camrus have a few sessions together where Boder is educated in the use of this wire recorder. And this is modern, this is cutting edge technology in 1945, 1946. And Boder is ready by the summer of 1946 to go to Europe armed with this recorder. And Boder recognizes that this recorder is going to serve as what he says a mechanical Ernie Pyle. I don't know how many of you have heard of Ernie Pyle, but he was one of the preeminent, yeah, a few in the back, preeminent reporters of the World War II era, embedded with the fighting men and in the trenches with them as the war progressed. Boter felt that the displaced people of Europe, and he had heard about the Holocaust, he felt that the displaced people of Europe and the Holocaust survivors in particular deserve their own Ernie Pyle, and that this machine would be able to serve that purpose. There had been plenty of photo documentation. When the Western troops and the Soviet troops liberated the camps on the eastern and western fringes of the German Reich, of course, photojournalists were able to show the skeletal survivors or the heaps of those who had died. And so there was much visual presentation of what had occurred. But Boter was keen that the voices of the survivors would be able to offer their own testimony. And armed with the wire recorder, he was determined to do that. General Eisenhower in the spring of 1945 had quite consciously and aggressively courted the American media, saying, we are finding these camps. Please, editors of America, send your best to over here to help us document this human atrocity. And so Boter, with the wire recorder, is coming with a different vehicle to be able to document what's occurred. This is just a excerpt of Boter's writing from the Illinois Tech Engineer, which was IIT's one of IIT's internal publications at the time. As a teacher of the source in perpetual education, I could not help observing that while literally hundreds of thousands of feet of visual material was collected to preserve the details of the war, practically nothing was preserved for the other perceptual avenue, the avenue of hearing. The magnetic wire recorder developed by the Armor Research Foundation appeared most suitable to fill that gap. So that's his statement on his purpose. It takes him a while to gain funding. He also has to arrange his sabbatical and things of this sort. And he finally is able to carve out the summer of 1946 to go with the wire recorder to Europe. He has to fight with the administration somewhat because GIs are coming back from the war, and IIT is about to enter upon its great post-war expansion with so many soldiers on the GI Bill coming. IIT was not keen to sacrifice a faculty member quite at that point, but Boter insisted, he finally was able to make his way. This is a photograph of Boter, probably taken within a few days of his arrival in Europe in July of 1946. He starts off, at this point, the displaced persons camps are throughout Europe, many in Western Europe. The highlighted areas here on this map are the ones that he visited, starting off in Paris and then going through to Northern Italy and then working his way through camps in what is now Western Germany, where he listens to survivor testimony. Another interesting part of this narrative is that Boter goes over very much with a social scientific and scientific bent. He has put together what he calls a traumatological index, which I've not seen the fine points of it, but is basically a quantifiable scale whereby he would attempt to quantify levels of trauma. To listen to testimony, to witness testimony from people who've been through traumatic experience, and then to infuse his traumatological scale, a very sort of strict formula for documenting in a very strictly social scientific way, a sort of detached scientific analysis of trauma. And to that end, he put together a series of questions, standard questions, of course, that would be presented to the people when he went into these displaced persons camps. He also stipulated that the interviewees were to not face him. They were to sit with their back to him. He would put the microphone in front of them, but then they were not to be influenced by his reactions, and he would ask his standard questions. It wasn't very long in the summer of 1946 when he arrives with a wire recorder and 300 spools of wire that he becomes taken more by the content of the story than by fulfilling the requirements of his traumatological index. He, at some point, tells the people, it's okay, face me. After a while, he says, I'm not going to ask you standardized questions. I'm only going to ask you two questions. Where you were you when the Germans came in? And then after that, tell me your story at your pace. What is it that the people of the Western world need to know? Bodur was shocked. Having been partly educated in the Germany of 30 years before, the Germany of pre-World War I, Bodur had a high respect for German discipline, German culture. And here he is hearing testimony that the lowliest member of the German armed forces could take out a pistol and dispatch prisoners without clearance up the chain of command. That profoundly shocked him. Listening to the tapes, listening to the wires, you learn not only the story of the survivors, but you hear this process of education and re-education that Bodur himself is undergoing. I failed to mention, I just have to, since it's such an oversight, said it here, his renaming himself, David Pablo Bodur. We don't quite know why he switched from Aaron Michelson to David, of course, the great Israelite king. Pablo is a middle name, perhaps a nod to his time in Mexico, and Bodur, we're not sure as well. We've not been able to seek that out. But here's a man who, in the 1920s, rebranded himself for his new career in North America. Back to 1946, as he's working through the camps and listening to these testimonies. He's already at this point pushing 60 years old, portly man, not in the best of shape. The wire recorder's pretty heavy. Western Europe in 1946 is still facing all manner of challenges, and he's at a breakneck pace by train and taxi cab, bartering with cigarettes to get from one camp to the next, carrying this equipment and trying to record as much as he can before he's scheduled to go back to the U.S. in September of 1946. He goes back and fulfills some of the teaching requirements at IIT, but now his life is transformed. Now he's on a different sort of a mission. The traumatological index has gone out the window. Now he's simply interested in transcribing as many of these interviews as possible to get the word out. It's interesting putting oneself back and doing research into this time period, because for many of us now, at 50, 60 years past this time period, of course, so many young people, and rightfully so, know about the Holocaust, know about this horrific event. The educational system in the country and the museum system in this country and across the world has done a good job in getting that message out there. But put yourself back in 1946, 1947. The war is over. Not only the Jewish people, but all manner of national groups have been massively dislocated. The focus in the Western world and throughout the world in 46, 47 is on moving forward. People are not interested in hearing details of some of the atrocities, not unless they were directly pertinent to, say, the trials at Nuremberg. But the Holocaust story is not as elevated in international consciousness at that point in 45, 46. And on the Israeli and the Jewish side, there's another reason for this initial disinclination to follow up with documentation on the Holocaust. This is, of course, the time period of the foundation of the State of Israel in the Zionist movement, in the perfection or the moving forward of the Zionist movement. The leaders in the Jewish communities in Europe are focused on solidifying the Jewish presence in Palestine, being ready for when the British mandate would end in 1947 to solidify an Israeli state. Jewish leaders and Zionist leaders at that point are not interested in discourse and discussion about the trauma, the loss, the weakness, the disruption. They want to move forward. As Bodur is interviewing survivors in 1946 in the displaced persons camps, he's also rubbing shoulders with Zionist activists who are busy trying to empty those camps on board ship to the new state being formed in Palestine. It's an interesting period of time in 1946 where there is, with Bodur, an interest in talking about that which has just happened, but amongst the Zionist leadership itself, there's more of an interest in, we need to move forward. We don't really want to discuss that. And indeed, some of the young Zionist leaders in the camps who had suffered the trauma didn't necessarily want to reveal a great amount of information to Boder. They weren't sure whether Boder was perhaps not associated with the British, and that if they revealed too much about themselves, that would interrupt their ability to transfer that population to the new state in Israel. So Boder is talking with people, some of whom are very open, and others who are much more guarded about what it is that he represents. Again, the interest in the Holocaust doesn't really take root until the early 1960s when Adolf Eichmann is captured in Argentina and brought to Jerusalem and put on trial. So Boder is kind of a lonely voice in academe at the end of the 1940s when he first publishes a number of the interviews. And he has this very, I put it here, in some degree of detail, because I think it's important that I am going to read it, because there's a passion behind the statement. This isn't the detached social scientist. This is somebody who's heard firsthand testimony, who has seen suffering individuals. For example, he sat down with one woman whose arm was still sort of syrupating from having excised her own tattoo out of her arm. She was determined to get that off of herself, and you know, there wasn't adequate medical people to do it for her, but he pointed to that and said, well, what did you do? And she said, well, it was the tattoo, and she said it ran deep, and you know, I was going to get that out. So he had seen, he'd heard not only the testimony, but he had seen the physical damage and the psychological damage. And so in the preface to this first volume in the late 1940s of Holocaust interviews, he says the displaced persons, in spite of their sorry state today, are not riffraff, not the scum of the earth, not the poor devils who suffer because they don't know their rights, not idlers who declaim that the world owes them a living. They are uprooted people. They represent the members of all classes in society, farmers, industrial workers, teachers, lawyers, engineers, merchants, artists, housewives, who have been dislocated by a world catastrophe. Trying to call the attention of the world to these people. Do not say that these people found themselves on the wrong side of history by their own ineptness, or by their own casualness, or by their own mistake, or their own fault. These are people who suffered because of a world catastrophe that was directed at them in particular. This is Holocaust awareness in a very, very early state, at a point when most people are not really interested in hearing that story. This book goes out of print after just one, you know, initial run, and it's not reissued. But Boder, as I indicate, transformed. His health starts to fail by the end of the 1940s. He's only in his mid-60s. Retires from IIT in 1952, but the federal government does provide some degree of funding for him to transcribe these interviews, and there are 120. And between 1947 and 1957, he transcribes uh, 70 of the 120, basically. As part of the requirement of this work, creates a copy set of his wires, a wire set of the original wire recordings, and that original wire set is turned over to the Library of Congress. So the National Institute of Health, which then forwards it to the Library of Congress in the late 1940s. Boder finally comes to the end of the government funding of his transcription and translation work in 1947-57. Most of the interviews are done not in English, as one would imagine, but they're in German or Eastern European languages, or Yiddish. And Boder knew a number of those languages, so he himself was able to create the translations and transcripts in English, as well as some original language documentation. After he retires from IIT in 1952, he joins his daughter, who's a dentist, out at Los Angeles, and he dies in the care of his daughter in Los Angeles in 1961. That's the biographical in historical context, that as an academic, I'm sorry, I had to give to you. Now moving on to more the technological aspects of this material. The original wires, a very interesting story, as far as we can determine. IIT sent me to UCLA in 2008 to try to find the original wires. We assume that since Voder died out in Los Angeles, perhaps the original wires had been deposited at Special Collections UCLA. They're not there. All that was there were one damaged reel, which perhaps is one of the original reels, but it's in multiple fragments. And then some scattered correspondence that had been turned over to UCLA. He actually had an office space at UCLA in the 1950s. He was not paid anything, but at least UCLA let him have an office space to continue his translation and transcription work. But just desultory materials are left at UCLA. Although Boder did one other oral history project, which was on wire, and I mention this because of where we're at. Apparently in 1951, Kansas City had a flood. And he attempted one last effort at the traumatological index, and he came to Kansas City, and there's like 6 to 7 wire recordings of interviews with survivors of the Kansas City flood of 1951. I don't know how well UCLA has documented that in terms of their cataloging, so I just throw it out to you there. Okay, now moving on to technological issues of this, and I will we'll leave at that slide for this point. Okay, first off, the audiological challenges. IIT, even though it had employed Boder and paid Boder's way, at least to a certain extent, to Europe in 1946, Boder left IIT in 1952 in a very disgruntled condition. That's part of the surviving correspondence at UCLA. He was retired at $10 a month in 1952, which is pretty bad even in 1952. And so he's not fond of IIT after 1952. There's evidence that he was in correspondence with Israeli universities to receive the original wires. But by the time of his death in 1961, that apparently had not happened. We've been in touch with Israeli universities. That transfer never occurred. Apparently, perhaps those wires were in his little UCLA office and they were pitched. We have done everything we can to try to locate them. They seem to be gone. So the copy set, the wire copy set that was made for the Library of Congress in the late 1940s is now, and Karen and I were discussing it, is now the primary source. Once IIT belatedly, after the 1960s and after Boder's death, started to take an interest in what Boder had done, in the 1990s a website was created to highlight this material, and it took 10 years to perfect the website. We had to go to LC to receive a DAT copy set of the surviving copy wires. And from 1998 to 2008, we audio engineered those wires to be able to make them presentable online. We also then identified translators who could translate the foreign language materials. Let me give this to you briefly. The original wires are gone. We are dealing with a 1949 copy set, which is now at the Library of Congress. They provided us with a 1998 DAT set. In around 2005, when I'm brought on board this project, we took these DAT materials to kind of a corporate audio operation in downtown Chicago. Very well-heeled, I won't give their name. But we felt that they could do good transfer to a gold CD for us and clean up some of the audio issues. They did, matter of fact, they cleaned them up too well. I think their experience had been to isolate and remove as much extraneous sound as possible so that one could understand the dialogue as clearly as possible, even if rather harsh and denuded of any audio context, any sort of patina. We listened to these initial CDs that were produced by this firm, and myself and my co-project person, Eben English, were very disappointed because we realized at that point that the background sounds mattered. You needed to hear that this interview had been conducted in a displaced persons camp or in a resettlement operation. You needed to hear the yells and the calls and the people walking through the rooms. There's no privacy. Everyone's crowded. You needed to catch the ambient atmosphere of 1946 displaced persons camp. We tried to communicate that to this audio firm. They just didn't get it. So we did the asking around sort of thing, trying to find the guy in the garage who has his own equipment, who's 70 years old, understands World War II, understands wire technology, and would be able to give it the sort of loving attention that it required. And we did find such a guy. And this is one of those cases where, thank goodness, the hobbyists will live forever because they have something quite special to contribute. So this fellow we found was able to create files that spiced up the interviews in such a way that they were intelligible insofar as was possible. Some of the original wires were too degraded, and there wasn't a lot you could do with some of them. But still, we were able to reach a balance between information, but also the context of these interviews conducted in the field in 1946. And by the way, these are the earliest extant audio files of Holocaust survivors done apart from U.S. government. And the U.S. government in 45, 46 apparently did some interviews, but we don't know what has happened with those. So Boder's materials from 46 are the earliest fresh wound documentation that we have. I am going to go to the website, and perhaps I should do that because we're already pushing 12:30 here. So, okay. And Kim, I might have to invite you up to get to the website. Thanks.
Here we go.
Okay, great. All right, and I want to show you how one can navigate through this here. Going to end with a. What did it do? Sorry.
And again, and we might not have time. Okay. I do want to give folks. We've got 5 minutes for questions. I'll work on this.
Okay.
And maybe we can. Do we have any questions for any of our? Thank you, Ralph. That was great.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Fascinating. And of course, we can. If you want to come up and look at the website with Ralph, that'll be fine. Any questions?
I have two questions. One regarding Boder. The Holocaust Museum has approached me a couple of times whether I know of any songs from the concentration camps, and would you know whether all the wires are spoken word, or are there also musical examples?
There actually are musical examples. We made a choice to limit this to the interviews about human experience, but yes, actually there were a fair amount of songs recorded, both Jewish songs and also camp songs that the Germans had forced the prisoners to sing. So those are part of LC's collection, and we have them at IIT on DAT, but they are not part of this website. You'd have to come visit us, or we could send you files, but we do have gold CDs of the songs.
Okay. My second question regards Studs Terkel.
Yes.
I understand that he not only wrote 18 books, but he had a daily radio program over many, many years, so he could not possibly have done that by himself. He must have had staff, a rather large staff at that, to research his interview partners, to contact the people, to prepare the questions. Have you found any such metadata, and have you tried to talk to the people who prepared his radio programs?
I know that he had a lot of staff at WFMT to help him. There's a couple books that document that with his staff to do exactly what you said, to help prepare, help him do this. But no, we didn't interview them because that's not part of the collection. We are just, our presentation and what we're doing is just the collection from the Chicago History Museum that they have. So. I'm sure there's more documentation and about that, but what we were talking about was just what we've received from the Chicago History Museum.
A question for both of you. Once you have reproduced the original source material onto the medium that you then use for your day-to-day research needs, what's your policies and technology that you use for the long-term storage of the original medium, and what's your policy for somebody if they come in and request to listen not to the first generation reissue, but to the original source material?
Well, as far as I know, and the original source material goes back to the Chicago History Museum, and we'll have we'll have made copies of that, and so anyone can listen to them, can come in and request to listen to them at our reading room in Washington, D.C. So are you asking if you want a copy of the material, or as for the long-term storage, they're on hard drives. I'll let Maya.
The question essentially is, does the original material then become especially cocooned for very, very long-term preservation, or does it just become subject to normal archival protocols?
Are you talking about the reels, like the tapes, or?
Correct, or wire recordings, or, you know, quarter-inch tapes. Do they, once it's reproduced, so that, you know, you're using it for everyday use,
right?
Bang around, does the original material then become virtually hermetically sealed for 50 or 100-year storage, or does it just become normal archivally stored?
Both, I think. I mean, we're going to be accessing the digital files, but we're going to be storing the original. Well, we're sending them back to Chicago History, so for now we're storing them in our vaults, but...
The originals will go back to the Chicago History Museum, so I think what I understand your question is, you would have to contact the Chicago History Museum and ask them what they plan to do with the original source materials.
I'll just mention, since I know they're set up there, they have cold storage. They have a very good cold storage facility, and so I imagine those are going back, and they will attempt to remove from use anything that's been copied.
We're not having the originals. Right.
Yeah, but in general, that's our policy.
I just got the website up. Ralph, do you want to just explain how folks can get to the website? I'll give you that up. Thanks.
Yeah, here, there's the opening page for the Voices of the Holocaust website at IIT. Do this at your leisure. But yes, Google Voices of the Holocaust. You will find it. And this is the opening. And explore the archives if we'd had time this morning. My apologies for getting too much into prologue, is to click on the explore the archive, and it will provide names, not only names, but by language. Very good, yes. So if you want to find testimonies by Polish survivors, Russian, whatnot, by interview date, by camp location, things of that sort, and then you receive these breakdowns that will, you click on, see if I can scroll. And then you start receiving.
Or hit the space.
Okay. But yes, then you'll be able to identify people who had been interned in certain camps if you want to hear testimony of people who survived certain camps or from certain ethnic groups. Then once you're able to call up individuals, then there will be a list of the tapes and the... right. And gosh, we will have enough time to maybe just at least grab one as a sample. So it should be enabled. Hmm.
But well, you will have to have your experience with your own machine, with which you'll be more familiar. But yes, it will come up with a scrolled text, which will highlight line by line where the audio is occurring. And even if it's in a foreign language, it's going to be highlighting an English translation. And so you'll be able to hear a survivor speaking in their language, showing the trauma they have experienced, discussing the loss of their children, the loss of their parents in the camp environment, but you'll be reading the English translation. This way you get the information. You don't need to know German, but you're also able to hear what is being said with the emotive experience and the testimony. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Rob. Any questions for Warren or Teague from the Academy? Yes. Mm-hmm.
Wire interviews. Have you done anything with regard to like a program like Glyphos OCRing transcripts and making them searchable and linked to the actual audio? There are some archives at UT that use this. It's really effective.
Oh, you mean in terms of word searchable?
In an online context, yeah.
No, I don't believe so. So that's yet to be done. If we do want to go that far with it, so.
I think it, I did want to ask Teague and Warren, it's interesting that you must have searched on Kansas City through keywords or somehow in the collection to find who mentions Kansas City. How did you, how is your search, your catalog set up that you can do kind of granular searches like that?
Well, I didn't really go into detail about all of our different catalog records we have for, we have an OPAC in Voyager that lists the transcripts that are just the volumes, but what you're asking about is an InMagic database where we fed in all of our transcripts, which really our indexes, which were originally done in as Word documents, and they were all put in into a database, okay. And each one is linked to the oral history and the oral history number. So if you type in Kansas City, you got the three oral histories that basically is pulling from multiple indexes from each oral history.
Like OCR.
And it gives you basically the oral history number and the transcript page numbers that's covered by. So you can go to the transcript, which then you can go from that to the audio and to the tape.
That's a powerful tool. That's great. Yeah. All right. Any other questions? I think it's 12:30. Mark, yeah.
Regarding the wire recordings, there was an awful lot of mention of the gold CDs and the DAT tapes, and I didn't really hear the online storage mentioned in any of that.
So I'm
curious for both you and LC, does LC have hard drive? Has that stuff come from DAT to hard drive for the wire recordings for Boder, and do you keep it on online hard disk instead of the gold CDs?
I'm the sort of history nerd part of this operation and not so much the technical aspect of it. But yes, it's on the university server, backed up any number of ways. And I understand that we've been, for people who are Holocaust deniers, that we've been hacked numerous times. It's just part of our reality that people attempt to crash us.
That's an amazing detail. Thank you.
Right. Any other questions? I think we're at 12:30 and everybody's hungry. And let's just thank everybody one more time. That was great. Thank you.